Clash of Champions 32. It was held on January 23rd, 1996. It was in Las Vegas, Nevada, and it drew a rating of 4.5, which, Matt, the WWE would crave a rating like that now.
Wrestling in general. I think Tony Khan would sell off his own father to get a rating that much.
Welcome back. It's been a while, Goudreau. It's been a while since it's been just the two of us. It's been a while since we've talked some wrestling. God knows, I mean, I say it a lot, but every time I edit, a lot of times in the background, I'll have either a baseball game or a wrestling event on. And I'm in the middle of 1999 now. I'm having fun going back and looking at these, and I'm glad we're getting back into the swing of the wrestling.
Took us long enough. I mean, we basically did what Hulk Hogan did when this company folded. We took our ball, went home, contemplated, are we going to get back to this? And then we're back to the poison, as Vince put it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, both of us have had a crazy year so far. And God knows, I mean, we spent a lot of this year recording 2.5-3 hour episodes about Star Wars and Alien and everything else. So it's only fitting that, you know, me and you just kind of take our little detour and do our hobby inside a hobby, shall we say, and review some wrestling. And we start this leg of it going back to a Clash of Champions. Now, Matt, do you remember Clash of Champions at all?
No, I didn't start watching WCW, specifically Nitro, until after these kind of went by the wayside.
Yeah, by this time, Nitro had taken over, and this, we'll get into it when we talk about the actual event, but Clash of Champions was being phased out at this point, but they were a huge part of my childhood, because it was always an anomaly to, like, it was a great treasure that you would find if you were to come home from school, you do your homework, you flipping through TV, you turn to TBS, oh my God, there's a Clash of Champions on. And they were like pay-per-view events on network television. It was so unheard of at the time. And this was an idea of Dusty Rhodes way back when. Dusty Rhodes had the idea when Vince was doing his whole thing of, and we'll talk about it eventually, we'll get to the golden era, but in 1987, when WCW, back then NWA, Crockett, would hold the Starrcade event, it would always be on Thanksgiving. And then what did Vince do one year in 1987? He put together the Survivor Series and put it head-to-head. First, he told Crockett, well, you can't have it on Thanksgiving, and any pay-per-view conglomerate who decides to hold this event is not going to get WrestleMania next year. Like, he really took the bull by the horns and played Mr. Businessman at this time. Boy, there's a wonder why WWF ended up eventually taking over, huh?
Well, you also have to remember, by the time Nitro, once you have live television, it kind of makes Clash of the Champions as a concept obsolete, in tandem with the fact that you're doing pay-per-views on a consistent basis now. So I think it made sense for Clash of Champions to kind of lose its luster, largely because when they first started, even at that point, less than a decade prior, the industry was a lot different. You know, television, wrestling on television was a much different mentality. So I'm not surprised. And looking at this show in particular, you can really start to see they're shifting their focus elsewhere.
They most certainly are. And going back to the history of it, like way back in the early days, Dusty Rhodes would, when Vince McMahon would hold WrestleMania, they would hold a Clash of Champions head-to-head against it. And people would flip over. I had one friend we had WrestleMania 5 at my house way back when. And he lived right down the street from me, but he said, I will come over, but only after Clash of Champions was over, because that was the year they had the Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat 2-3 falls match on Clash of Champions, and he had to watch that before. So the Clash of Champions is a way for WCW to hold these huge events, free TV, plug their pay-per-views, and the events were always events. You know, there was always something exciting going on at those. They were appointment television for me as a kid growing up. But you're right. In 1995, 1996, when Eric Bischoff took over, TV wrestling was more important than ever to have these ratings. And so Bischoff made the choice to phase it out. But we'll get to it when we get deeper into the Attitude Era. Ted Turner didn't want wrestling to go away from TBS. And so that is a big reason why we eventually had Thunder a couple years later.
Yep, and then WWF would follow suit by doing another secondary themed show that also color-coded blue.
Yes. Okay, so this particular Clash of Champions, this was a time, we've talked about it, we are a few months away from the NWO coming full swing into WCW and changing wrestling forever. Man, at this point, we're still dealing with the goddamn Dungeon of Doom. We're dealing with a whole bunch of bullshit on this.
Only for a couple more months, though. Let's get past Uncensored. We can just pretend the Dungeon of Doom, we will give it the Benoit treatment. It doesn't exist. But it's also weird. We talk about how wrestling, a lot of times, it's doing the opposite of what you did previously. If you remember, 94, which is before we started doing these shows the way we did, Hogan was champion for over a year. He won the title at Bash at the Beach, loses it to the Giant, who holds it for a week. The title is then vacated, Savage wins it, which we talked about, then Flair wins it, and in between Starrcade and this show we're talking about, Savage won it again on an episode of Nitro. So they've hot-shotted the title 5 times in the past 2.5 months.
Yeah.
And we're coming off, on the other company, we're coming off Diesel's reign, which lasted almost a year. So you're really starting to see the days of really long championship reigns, you know, going back to like the Backlund era or, you know, San Martino.
Yeah.
Those days are long gone. I mean, we're going to talk about the big Hogan one, but that was part of an ongoing story, not necessarily specifically about the title's lineage.
Yeah, and as we get deeper in, I mean, we'll talk about how the Russo era really took that and ran with it. And by the time, you know, I mean, I used to get these wrestling magazines and these wrestling books that would detail the history of the titles and things. And there was a point in time when me and my friends kind of threw our arms up and were like, we don't even know who has a title anymore. They changed hands so much. All right, so this Clash of Champions, we have the commentary team of Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan. At this point, I think Bobby Heenan was still pretty much into it. You know, there's going to become a time when he really just flat out stops giving a fuck. And there's a moment here that is notorious that I can't wait to talk about.
Yeah, this is one of those shows where it's known more for the mishaps and the...
Yeah.
It's not really known for the wrestling, which makes sense when you look at this card and you look at how much wrestling is actually on this show.
Example number one, our first match. We have the Nasty Boys. Brian Knobbs and Jerry Sags are taking on Public Enemy, Johnny Grunge, and Flyboy Rocco Rock. So,
I mean,
yeah,
both names could apply because Knobbs and Sags are Public Enemy to everyone except for Hulk Hogan.
You know what? I got to say, there was a period of time in the early 90s when these guys first started making their appearances on WCW. Not so much when they got to the WWF, but when they were in WCW, they had some killer matches with the Steiner brothers that are hard-hitting, great matches. God, I can't wait to get to that stuff with you. But yeah, by this time, they had pretty much become a farce. And of course, Brian Knobbs, big-time friend of Hulk Hogan's, as you said. And, you know, there's a reason he stuck around after Jerry Sags pretty much bailed on this tag team a few years later. But here we go. So this match is...
Remember, on record, Bischoff has said he has stolen nothing from ECW.
He always says that it was Kevin Sullivan, who was booking at this time, who pushed for these ECW guys, because Kevin Sullivan always watched it, and he just kind of backed off and stayed away. But he's the one who signed off on this. So we have tons of chaos inside, outside the ring. We have Johnny Grunge and Brian Knobbs are battling on the outside. We have Rocco Rock and Sags are brawling on the outside as well. Sags is dropped right on the guardrail. But 30 seconds in, he's walking back towards the back to grab a table and bring it to the ring. We're bringing the table out already, and we're not even a minute in. Sags hits a pile driver on Johnny Grunge as the Nasty Boys, they set up the table. And then we have Nick Patrick. He's calling for the bell because these guys are just going, there's just too much chaos going on. He can't control it.
Yeah, he calls for the bell even though the table spot has not actually been performed.
Yeah, so he stops it like a little after 3 minutes. They keep fighting. Sags goes up to the top rope, but he gets knocked off. And then Johnny Grunge sets Knobs right on top of the table. And then Rocco Rock just does this beautiful moonsault, but the table doesn't even break because this table is not gimmicked enough at this point.
This company was not doing a lot of the, you know, those more flimsy tables that you'd see in a couple years that, you know, WWF really put those into pop culture. Because even during the Monday Night Wars, as we'll talk about, and even when WCW made their own hardcore division, largely just because they were trying to play catch-up, they didn't do a whole lot of elaborate table spots.
for sure. Now, these two teams, we're going to talk about them a lot when we get into this era, because they every time we turn on a pay-per-view at this time, it seemed like they were always the opening match. But this match is just too short to call. It's barely over 3 minutes. We just get a little bit of brawling, and this goes to your point, Matt, where, you know, when Clash of Champions started, it was 2.5 hours, and you always had some good length to these matches. You know, you had Flair and whatnot on these cards, and there's always some kind of drama being built up. Here, though, we are only at 2 hours, which is the length of a Nitro eventually in a year or so. So it's just basically an expanded episode of Nitro, and here we have the first match being a little over 3 minutes. We know how this show is going to go.
Yeah, and also I think the post-match beatdown went longer than the actual match, and there's one of my favorite things. If you notice, the table doesn't break, but there's this giant shard of wood that breaks off. I thought that was going to fly into the crowd and kill somebody.
I thought of a kid that was probably in the line of shrapnel when it went flying.
Yeah, you can't even, like, grade this, because it's more of a segment than it is a actual match.
Exactly. Okay, so next we have Ric Flair and the Giant. They're out to talk about Ric Flair's title loss to the Macho Man, as you mentioned, Matt. It didn't mean anything to him because he's going to get it back anyway. So,
I mean, he's technically right.
Yeah, he is.
And I also love, if you watch this on Peacock, they will run the old ads as they were, and they talk about an advertisement for Super Brawl, which is the next pay-per-view. They talk about former, present, and future champions. They show Stan Savage as the incumbents, and they show Lex Luger as the future. And I'm like, I guess technically it's foreshadowing, but you think they would have picked someone who is not yet a world champion to kind of tease who... Because really, even though this is the beginning of 96, you're really starting to see, as we talk about the rest of this card, they're really building up the meat and potatoes of their talent roster that, in a large way, were the workhorses of the company when they were kicking Vince's ass.
Yeah, definitely. So our next match is, we have, speaking of the future of the company, we have Dean Malenko and Alex Wright. We've talked about Alex Wright in the past, but Dean Malenko, is this our first time mentioning Dean Malenko on this podcast? I believe so.
I think so.
How do you feel about Dean Malenko as a performer, as somebody who would be in this game for quite a while?
You know, on his own, I think he's very technically proficient. But it's one of those things, when you're lumped in with the group that involves Guerrero and Benoit, and even Jericho to a certain degree, I think he's a distant fourth. Largely because he just didn't have the personality to...
Definitely.
To connect with people on that level. You know, because I think him and Benoit were pretty similar as far as promo ability and all that. But for some reason, Malenko's like Iceman type of persona, just, it's hard to make that resonate. Benoit, they made that his gimmick in a lot of ways. But Dean just could never, you know, we joke about vanilla midgets. He could just never get past that proverbial glass ceiling. But as far as a worker, I mean, when I think of the cruiserweight division, as we'll come to know it, he's probably top of the list as far as, you know, being one of the top guys in that spot.
This was Malenko's prime, I think. I think from 96 to 98.
Yeah.
Up
until the Jericho feud, where he won the Battle Royal dressed as somebody else.
Yeah, he dressed as Syncope, I think is who it was. And he masked. See, that was a great moment to me. I thought that was an amazing moment. I thought that was the peak. And then he started getting involved in storylines, and they were kind of downplaying his character. Then he was like, I want to be a part of the Horsemen. And, you know, his character just kind of took a downturn after that. But I think when he had these steel eyes, and he's going into these matches, and he's all business, and, you know, he's trolling his wrists as he's coming to the ring, and as soon as he gets in, he puts on these clinics, and I think as they were playing up his Man of a Thousand Holds gimmick, I think he was really awesome.
And Alex Wright, I was looked at as kind of on the precipice of cruiserweight, because he's so much taller than all the other cruiserweights.
Yeah,
because like, you know, Malenko was like 5'8", 5'9", Guerrero and Benoit were both under 6 feet. He's tall, but he's still in the weight-wise what you would think of as a cruiserweight, even though they kept changing the weight limit on that division. Because I think it's supposed to be like 215, but Jericho, when he was champion, was almost 230. The whole crux of this match is basically Malenko put him in the cloverleaf, and he just didn't let go. That's why we're having this match.
Yep, the WCW Saturday Night right before this, which was the flagship show for a while, again, until Nitro kind of took over. By this point, Saturday Night, it was another one that was eventually being phased out. This match, we start off with a bunch of chain wrestling, and Dean Malenko, he's working on the injured leg of Alex Wright. Wright hits a superplex, but he only gets a two count on it. Malenko clips Wright in the knee and hits a slick roll-up for the win. But it looked like this spot was a little screwy because Wright had his shoulder up.
Yeah,
it was...
he blatantly kicks out, but they still have three.
Such a weird match, a weird ending to a match that I thought was pretty entertaining. Only went about 5 minutes, 29 seconds, but I think we could say this about a lot of matches on this card. I think it could have gone longer.
Yeah, I mean, they did the best with what they were given. This is the definition of get your shit in and leave. You know, because there's some good transition stuff in here, like Malenko working the leg. You see Wright do some top rope stuff with the crossbody. So the guys got themselves over as far as an athletic part. And it's not even a standard pin. He does the jackknife flip cover.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a hard spot to botch. And the fact that he's so clearly kicked out makes it even worse. So right away, you're like, we've had two matches. One was a glorified run-in segment, and this one had a pretty blatantly botched finish. Not off to a great start.
Well, you think that's bad. Wait until we talk about what's next.
Oh, well, yeah, you mentioned the words Disco Inferno.
Yes.
Need I say more? It makes me want to burn this show to the ground alone.
Oh, I love how much heat Disco Inferno gets out of people. Because you listen to, like, Tony Schiavone's podcast, he hates him. Like, everybody just hates this guy for some reason. Kind of seems like a shit stir, but here we go. We have Taskmaster Kevin Sullivan. He's out. He's taking on Disco Inferno, supposedly. But as Disco was supposed to come out, we have an Elvis impersonator come to the ring. He's eating a peanut butter sandwich. This is before the era of Vince Russo, by the way. Elvis is here to deliver a singing telegram that tells us that Disco Inferno wasn't going to make it to the match because he was at the Colonel Parker Sherry wedding. He starts to sing, and then Sullivan just beats the crap out of him, and the crowd's cheering, so I guess he's supposed to be a babyface at this point, but he's, I don't know. We have no clue who this is. This isn't even an official match. The referee just kind of throws it out because Disco's not here.
Yeah,
yes, those are the words that came out of my mouth.
Yeah, and then they just have Jimmy Hart grab the mic and shit on Elvis impersonators, even though he managed Tonky Tonk for a couple years. I guess because that's the other promotion, it's not part of history.
Wow. Watching this back for this particular podcast, Matt, it was really interesting to see what this era consisted of. Because we have a weird mixture of stuff that we're going to eventually get with the NWO and the realistic approach to wrestling and a lot of the cartoonist shit that WCW was still doing back in 94, 95.
It's so funny when you look at this and then you think about where this company will be in 6 months from now. It feels like you're jumping forward in time 3 years, not 6 months.
So then we have Eric Bischoff. He's out to introduce Lex Luger and Sting as the new tag team champions. Sting just isn't sure about Lex Luger's allegiance since his return to WCW. And so the news champs, they have some controversy. And then we have the Road Warriors, who they just returned to WCW. They're suddenly walking out to confront Sting and Luger. Sting is extremely excited to see these guys back, but Luger is just not excited to see him at all.
That's because Lex Luger doesn't know how to emote.
Sting offers the Road Warriors a shot at the titles, and Luger's not feeling it. He says other teams like Harlem Heat and State Patrol. State Patrol is one of my favorite tag teams. They were like these jobber tag teams from like the late 80s, early 90s. Like they would always just lose on TV, but here's Luger putting him over. I love this era of Sting and Luger. I thought this angle was amazing, and I really think they could have done something with it. Of course, the NWO comes, and this whole thing gets pretty much thrown out. But I think I've mentioned it every time we have Sting and Luger on these shows. I just think this angle was amazing. I just love how Luger's like, he's the bad guy, and Sting's kind of wanting to accept him, but not really. And Luger's doing a lot of bad guy things, and Sting just kind of brushing it off. This was good stuff. This is my favorite part of this era was this angle.
Oh, yeah, these two are going to be interconnected until this company goes under.
Uh-huh.
They'll have a shared history that continues. And this is sort of the last breath of the pre-Crow incarnation of Sting is this next, like, 6 months, where it's a radical departure. It's cool to see the Road Warriors, but then you think a year later, they're going back to WWF.
Yeah.
So I also love how they mentioned the American Males.
Yes.
Which is that's really low down the your tag team rankings. Granted, they would win the titles eventually. But that's like also a very deep cut.
Very much so.
And this starts, again, Sting is the biggest moron in the history of wrestling because this guy has been turned on more times than a Ouija board with his partners. Like, he was always portrayed as an idiot. Even when he becomes Crow Sting, he gets turned on.
Yeah.
Like, that was his whole thing. I mean, we talked about it last year with the Flair Arn Anderson, Brian Pillman thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he is to WCW what Tommy Dreamer was to ECW. Everybody just will, every tag team partner will turn on them at some point.
Sting was a huge part of my childhood. I loved that character growing up. You know, if there was anything WCW could grasp onto, it was Sting. And he did have a title reign starting in 90, and we'll eventually talk about that. But he wasn't really a big box office draw as a champion once he finally got the belt. I think he was better as the one who pursued it. But he was such a huge, huge character in my eyes. But the more I look at him, I look at him and I say, man, why didn't you fight for your character more? You know, because these were angles that he would get involved in all the time. And you're right, Matt. Every single time he looked like an idiot. At 1990, the Horsemen turned on him, for God's sake. He was a member of the goddamn Horsemen. How'd you think that was going to end up? There's just so much going on here that made him look like a moron. And it just didn't change. And I think it stems from a lot of the fact that he'll be the first to tell you this. You know, he was not a huge wrestling fan growing up. He wasn't huge into the business. He just kind of came in. He was one of these guys who came in. And he was like the Goldberg before Goldberg. He came in to collect his paycheck and went home. He didn't really think about the psychology and stuff that went on with this. If he thought about that more, I think maybe his character would come off much better.
Maybe they needed another movie for him to base his paint off of.
Maybe. So next up, we have Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who's in a neck brace, and he's saying that the Four Horsemen ended his career because he turned them down and Brian Pillman took his spot. This is a weird interview. Orndorff, of course, he's saying he'll come back, but he never comes back again. He ends up becoming an agent for the company. He was one of the top stars in the business, taking on Hulk Hogan just 10 years before. But man, he had tons of injuries and his career was cut way short. But we have him on TV here. What is this, his last hurrah, whatever? This is just a weird interview.
Well, I think they were clearly setting up an actual angle, but just physically, he could never get back in the ring. So it's clear they're trying to build towards something, but it never got fully realized just based on his health.
Yep. So we go back to the chapel as Colonel Parker, he's late to his own wedding. And I love this bit. He asked Mean Gene for $50 so he could get a cab. Gene is always hilarious in these bits. He's calling the cab driver Jabroni, by the way, because he's honking his horn. This is fun stuff. I like this. I guess you're not a fan of the wedding angle, huh?
Well, I've never found the Colonel Parker character. It's weird that we just had a whole segment about Elvis impersonators, and then we have someone who's pretending to be Colonel Parker, who was Elvis's manager.
Exactly. So here we have, now this is a match that on paper I thought looked amazing. We have Flying Brian Pillman taking on Eddie Guerrero. This is Flying Brian playing his loose cannon character. He's out of control. He's going after fans at ringside, not really paying attention to Eddie in the ring. He hits a drop kick to Pillman, who falls out near Heenan and Schiavone. Here we go. Pillman's in character. He's wandering around, and then as he passes Heenan, he grabs a hold of Heenan's neck. You just hear Heenan say, "What the fuck are you doing?" right into the mic.
Yep, and it's live on air. Like, it's one of the things that you could not have planned. It's as organic as can be. And I get it. He was definitely freaked out by him grabbing his neck. Maybe he thought it was a fan initially. But he also had neck problems at this time.
Yeah, he had neck problems going back to the 80s.
Yeah, which is why he was clearly so pissed off.
He is so pissed off that he literally gets up and starts walking towards the back. It is, you're right, it's the most organic moment. And Bischoff on his podcast does say he loved moments like this because when you're live on TV, this is when shit like this happens. You know, if you were not live, you could edit this stuff out and make it look like it never happened. But I love this moment, and it's still to this day, like, I think, like, when you have people like Heenan break character like this, it really makes for a fun time. Then, goddamn, I don't know if Flying Brian was crazy enough where Heenan probably thought something was going to happen.
I think so. But it's always funny when guys like Heenan or Gene Okerlund, when they lose their shit, like when the set fell down and Okerlund just yells, "Fuck it," while they were on. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
When it comes to guys who live and breathe the business, it's funnier.
Definitely. So back to the match. Eddie Guerrero, he hits a spinning DDT out of the corner, and then he just chops Pillman to hell. They both go for a crossbody, which was a great spot, but Pillman was able to get the best of it. He rolled up Eddie with a handful of tights for the win at 5 minutes and 59 seconds. This is definitely before Eddie Guerrero would find his groove. He is still like the white meat baby face. Pillman's definitely the bigger character here, but I thought this was a pretty entertaining 6-minute match.
Well, they had to keep Pillman strong with the whole Horseman reintroduction that happened late in the previous year. So it made sense for him to go over, but you're right. The biggest problem is that Eddie was not, there was nothing about him that was distinctive outside of the family name, and it wouldn't be until 97 that he'd really come into his own.
So next we have Hogan, Macho Man, and Kevin Green. They're out with Bischoff, hyping their match tonight.
Boy, Kevin Green dates this so badly.
He really does. And God bless the man. We lost him a couple years ago. You could not get enough enthusiasm out of this guy. You could tell he's one of those guys who just, quote unquote, got it. You know, he loved wrestling growing up. You could tell he was a huge fan. And him being here, you know, this is how I would be if I was a part of this event as well. I would just be nothing but enthusiasm and probably not really be that great on camera. But Kevin Green was just amazing when it came to stuff like this. So we then have Sting and Lex Luger. They're putting the World Tag Team titles on the line against the Blue Bloods, who is Lord Steven Regal and Earl Robert Eaton.
If you're wondering, Regal's knee is taped up because this is something that did not air. He had a dark match with Benoit, and he got hurt somehow.
Yes.
So he's working this match with a taped knee that was legitimately hurt. And Bobby Heenan, because of that, is like, he keeps saying, oh, it's a fake. Like,
yes.
Like it's a trick. So they worked around it the best they could, but you can clearly see he's favoring that leg.
Definitely. So the match goes. We have Luger and Sting. They're controlling most of the early part of it on both Regal and Eaton. And then the Blue Bloods, they switch in and they get the advantage. Eaton goes up to the top rope and tries a cross body press, but Luger somewhat caught him. But instead, he just kind of falls. Luger was the most clumsy fucking wrestler on the planet.
Yeah, him and Sid could both fight for that argument.
Oh my God! When those two fought, it was like
it was like watching Godzilla and King Kong if they were both quadriplegics.
Well, funny, we were talking about Clash of Champions. They did fight on a Clash of Champions back in, I think it was 90, maybe 89, and Luger was they were giving him a pretty big push at that point. And Vicious comes out, and Vicious was, you know, he was the big time heel, and he comes out and Luger clotheslines him, pins him. That's it.
Yep.
It was a squash, pretty much, which was crazy to do to Sid at that time. But this is 7 years later. So Sting enters the match, and of course, he gains control. All four guys are going at it. Eaton goes back to the top rope, but he's accidentally knocked off by Regal. Sting then slaps on the Scorpion Deathlock for the win at 7 minutes, 47 seconds. Again, an entertaining match, but too short.
Too short, and God, that botched power slam looked ugly.
Oh, it looked bad. Yeah.
Like, and there's like a 10-second lapse where nobody knew what to do.
Uh-huh.
Which I get, you know, when you, because that was supposed to lead into the hot tag, so I'm sure it threw off everything. But it's fine. I kind of wish they saved because the previous Nitro, they won the tag belts from Harlem Heat. They should have just done that on this show.
Yes.
Because instead we have Harlem Heat on the show complaining about the lack of neck bones.
I was just getting to that. So we go back to the chapel. Harlem Heat, as you mentioned, they're bitching about the lack of neck bones. Sherry finally shows up looking really disheveled. And you know what? I'm a huge fan of Sherry. I think she was a really, really great character. A great foil for Macho Man, Macho King at that point in the 80s and 90s. She was a big part of that WWF. And when she got to WCW, you could tell the years were kind of catching up to her. And this is not her at her best.
No, but this was the last great managerial role she had, was with Harlem Heat. Once they got rid of the Colonel Parker shit and she became Sister Sherry, I think she refound her groove. But she was still with the Parker thing. That was not the most... Look, again, racism be damned when it comes to pro wrestling. But yeah, I think it would be a little while before she refound her groove, because she had just come over within, what, the last year?
June of 94. So she'd been here, about a year and a half.
Yeah. And she was with everybody. Like, she was with Savage, she was with DiBiase, she was with Shawn Michaels. So she...
Yeah.
And everyone she was with, she played an integral role with in some way. Here, it's like, all right, we'll put her with there to get the rub on Harlem Heat, but they also didn't need it, because they were a great tag team, but I think they also knew the Parker thing had run its course. And we're looking to get rid of this relatively quickly.
So Sherry's pissed off at Parker for looking as disheveled as he is and for him gambling all his money away. And Schiavone delivers the perfect line here where he says, get in the limo and run for your life. You know, this stuff is goofy. You know, we have this Sherry Colonel Robert Parker gimmick that it's just, it is goofy, but I thought it was fun. And re-watching it, I thought I was going to cringe every time they were on screen, but I actually smiled every time.
Yeah, this is not as bad as some of the stuff you would see either before this or not too long out. Like, this is not Beaver Cleavage.
Oh, my God. Oh, I just reached that. I just reached like that. Holy shit. Yeah, saving it. So Brian Pillman comes back out, and he tells Bischoff that he's going to say the seven deadly words on TV that you're not supposed to say. And so we're playing up the loose cannon gimmick at this point.
Yeah, and those seven words are Bret Hart giving Goldberg a nice compliment. We'll never hear those on television.
Never, ever. Never, ever. So next up, we have Psicosis taking on Mexican heavyweight champion Conan. For these matches, it was always fun because we had Mike Tenay joining the team. This was before Tenay kind of became another voice on the broadcast. He would come on and do these big light heavyweight or,
store stuff. He was like
the
cruiserweight liaison. And I think he was good in that role.
I thought he was too.
Once he became a permanent color commentator, all he did was just tell you exposition. And the it got worse in TNA, which we'll never talk about. But they paired him with Don West. It was just those two guys sounded like 10-year-old girls, you know, marking out every body slam. It just got so bad. But in this role, I think Mike Tenay was fine because nobody knew who Conan was in the States. And Psicosis had obviously the great look with the mask and the bodysuit and all that stuff. So
yeah, and you know what? You got to give Bischoff this. You know, at this point, commentating was different in wrestling in that we had two, sometimes three guys, the same three guys just talking about the matches, and we never really get any real background unless you have a really good color commentator. But here's Mike Tenay coming into the booth, you know, at this particular time for this particular match, giving background on both these guys, giving us a great story. And he really served a purpose here, and this is all due to Bischoff. You know, he kind of saw something in Tenay, brought him in, and this was the perfect role for him, as you said.
They also couldn't – he's technically not AAA champion either. So they just call it the Mexican title.
Yeah. And then I remember – God, I remember I had a tape of the 1990 Starrcade, and Conan was on that. You know, he was in WCW even before. You know, he was in the tag team tournament that they had back then. So, you know, this isn't his first cup of coffee in WCW. Of course, he'd be staying around until – he was around until the end, right? Or was he?
I think – well, No Limit Soldiers. Yeah, Felt the Animals was late 2000. I think he's on the last show probably.
Okay.
But I know if he was doing anything good, the answer for that is no. And he had done, you know, he had a stint in ECW right before this. But this, right around this time, was when he came to WCW and actually started working full time. Because he debuted on the Nitro before this. Or I say re-debuted. And he's the guy who brought in so many of the luchadors. You know, Psicosis, Juventud, La Parca, Rey Mysterio. So he's a big factor in that becoming a huge component of this company. And I don't think he gets enough credit for it other than himself.
Yeah, he'll definitely play himself up too. So this is right at the cusp of the cruiserweight division really taking off and in international matches and things. And Conan looks in pretty good shape here. Man, he's using some high-speed maneuvers, which he wouldn't use in his later career in WCW.
No, he's also not a cruiserweight.
No, he wasn't a cruiserweight, but what I'm saying is he was part of the rave of cruiserweights that kind of entered in around this time.
Mm-hmm.
So Conan, he hits a DDT that really just puts Psicosis right into the mat. What a crazy DDT that was. Psicosis hits a suicide dive to the outside, but nearly kills himself with this move.
Oh my.
Conan then hits an excellent suplex, and then he puts some kind of weird submission hold on Psicosis, and that was that at 5 minutes and 29 seconds. The submission didn't really look that good, but this was an entertaining match for the most part.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't know if that's supposed to be like a standing figure four leg lock. I don't know what that is supposed to be.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck that is either. He wouldn't use it for that long in this.
Well, he'd switch to the single leg Boston Crab, wouldn't he?
Yeah, the Tequila Sunrise, right?
Yeah.
Entertaining for what it is. Speaking of entertaining, we're going back to the chapel as Sherry is changing in the back of the limo, and Oakland just says, I doubt this is the first time she's been in the back of a car. Oh, Mean Gene was so fantastic. He then offers to walk her down the aisle, which is pretty much the driveway, as he's known her for a very long time. We have Harlem Heat.
How they make Oakland say this is the biggest wedding in TV history.
I know. We have Harlem Heat. We have Disco Inferno. We have others singing the wedding song as they make their way to the drive-thru. Dirty Dick Slater, he gets emotional. Mean Gene's cracking up. Booker T shaking his head. And then, out of nowhere, here comes Medusa. She walks out of Parkler's trailer, and she and Sherry just start brawling all over the reception area. Apparently, Medusa was Parker's side chick. You know, she was the one that he was cheating on her with. Cool nod to Sherry and Medusa's feud while they were in AWA, because they fought each other while they were there. This whole segment's just glorious. I fucking love this. I'm sorry. Maybe that's the nostalgia coming out of me, but I fucking rolled this entire segment.
I think this is legitimately funny, but I also have a perverse sense of humor, so I can understand why this doesn't appeal to everybody. But what this literally becomes a Jerry Springer segment by the end.
Yeah. Yes, and exactly.
I don't know if that show was fully embedded into pop culture yet, but it was about to.
It was about to, yeah. It's definitely around. Because I remember me and my friend would watch it a lot around this time. So here we are, Goudreau. We're at the main event. Michael Buffer's out. He gets another $250,000 check as he's introducing Ric Flair and the Giant versus Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage, who's out here with Kevin Green, as I mentioned. But they're also here with who? Woman, a.k.a. Nancy Benoit. She would be Benoit later on. And Miss Elizabeth, who's making her first appearance here in WCW. This was WWF royalty, was Miss Elizabeth when she was there with Savage. They were known as wrestling's first couple. I loved Miss Elizabeth and Macho Man and that whole dynamic with Hogan. We're going to get to that storyline eventually. That is one of my favorite storylines of all time in wrestling. Bringing her out here in WCW, it was great to see her. I know Macho Man and her still had a good relationship at this time. Macho Man was pretty protective of her still, although obviously they weren't a couple anymore. But he kind of looked at her as a little sister. If you listen to Bischoff's podcast, I liked seeing her, but WCW really ran out of things to do with her.
I would disagree on that last front because I think that what we'll talk about in a couple shows down the road made a lot of sense. And I also like that her introduction to WCW audiences is with Ric Flair because they have the history from 92
yeah.
with the WrestleMania 8 build. So I thought this made... She's the focus of this entire segment, basically. Not the world title, not Hogan, which is also shocking. Although earlier when they did their promo, Hogan came out after the WCW world champion. So even as champion, Savage is still Hogan's underling. I wonder why you hated this man so much.
Oh, and I bleed red and yellow. I'm sorry. So we're starting off. We have Kevin Green getting in the face of Ric Flair. And then Macho Man and Flair, they start things out. They're doing their usual back and forth. These two always had great chemistry, though, every time they were in the ring. I love watching these two wrestle. The Giant is then tagged in. And then here comes Hogan. He comes in. So Hogan gets shoved by the Giant twice in a row. And then Hogan attempts a slam because he has to do this spot. But he just couldn't pick him up. We have Schiavone and Heenan. They bring up the opening moments of WrestleMania 3 when Hogan failed to do the same thing to slam the Giant. Or slam Andre the Giant.
Even sells the back giving out like he did.
Yes, the exact same way. So we have the Giant missing an elbow. Hogan successfully body slams him, but it takes a toll on him. Flair is tagged in, and he hits a suplex on Hogan. Flair then goes to the top rope, but Hogan catches him and flings him across the ring before making the tag to Savage. Savage enters and goes to work on Flair as he nails an elbow drop from the top, but Hart is on the apron as the ref is distracted. Hogan and the Giant, they're brawling on the outside. Flair has a foreign object in his hand as he slugs Savage with the object to grab the win at 9 minutes and 52 seconds. Entertaining enough match. We actually have one that's over 5 minutes, which is nice.
Yeah, this one went almost 10, but I disagree with... God, you're going to have Savage lose again? I know there's underhanded means, but even when he's champion, he's booked like crap. Remember when he wins the title of World War III, Hogan comes in and throws a hissy fit and not going to hold the belt especially long. Yeah, just not a way to make your champion look overly strong.
Definitely not. Although, I thought this was a step up from previous clashes the last couple years. Not a good way to end it if you're going to have the good guys lose. You know, and you have to say too, Matt, that at this point they're running Nitro as well. So we're on the second show here, which makes this, you know, the future Thunder. Thunder would eventually take this role of being just kind of the secondary show. And like I said in the beginning of this, I love Clash of Champions so much. Always looked forward to them. But at this point, I knew that, you know what? They're not giving a shit about Clash of Champions anymore. And it didn't have a big time feel that I loved so much growing up.
Well, no, you can clearly see the writing on the wall because on the Nitro before this, you had two title changes.
Yes.
On this show, you don't have any. So if that's not telling you that this show is already being reduced in the totem pole, I don't know what else you need to see.
All right, Goudreau, scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Clash of Champions 32?
I'm wrestling between a 3 or a 2, no pun intended, but I'm not going to go that low. I just can't resist the bait. There's a lot of stuff going on this show, but the question is, what does it amount to? And the answer to the equation is not a lot at all. Unlike a lot of shows around this time, though, like we talked about some bad shows recently.
Get ready for next week. Go ahead.
But, you know, there's only like one or two things on the show that I thought were absolutely like atrocious. But at the same time, I think this is kind of a disservice to the lineage of this, of what these shows used to be. Look at the Nitro before this. I mean, you're already starting to see the seismic shift in prioritization. And I think part of that's also just because they were about to go into direct competition if they were not already. You're on that horizon. So you think, oh, maybe we could have at least done one title change on this show, but nope, they did them all on Nitro. So, yeah, a lot of wrestling is really short, as we joked about. If even for WCW, some of the booking decisions are a little strange, but look, you can say that a lot about this company in the next 5 years. All in all, it's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but I'm not going to call it particularly good. So, I'm going to give it a 4, like a high 4. It's also not painful to sit through. It's like sitting through a mediocre episode of Nitro from like 1995, before this company really got its shit together.
Is it like sitting through a Children of the Corn film, though?
I've only seen the first one.
To be determined. You know, I'm pretty much on the same page as you, although I do think that there's some things about this show that are kind of must-sees. One, you gotta look up the Heenan moment with Pillman. If you haven't seen it already, if you're listening to this podcast, you more than likely are aware of it. But it's something that is so organic, as you mentioned, Matt, that it needs to be seen to be believed, because Heenan never broke character like this. And the fact that he almost walked all the way back to the back and was like, fuck this. It's a moment that I will never, ever forget. When I was watching it live, just thinking, wow, was that really supposed to? Oh, wait, no, it didn't. You knew from that moment it didn't. Also, I think the fucking wedding segments are pure gold. I love the way it developed. I loved seeing Medusa come out. And, you know, she had made an impact just a month before by throwing the WWF women's title in the garbage. And here she is. You know, she obviously wouldn't make too big an impact. You know, we'll talk about that as we get into these Monday Night Wars. But here, I thought it was a great way to reintroduce her into the storylines, pitting her against Sherry, her old AWA running mate. And I think that the final tag match is entertaining enough. You know, it's the epitome of the main event scene of WCW back in the mid-90s, right before the NWO would take it over. But you know what? With the exception of those few things, there's really not much to grasp onto, although, like you said, it's not too painful. But given the segments that I mentioned, I am going to go 1 point higher than you. I'm going to go 5. I do think, again, this is much more entertaining than any of the clashes in 95 and most of the clashes from 94. So, yeah, I mean, they would only have 3 more of these shows. It's a shame to see them phased out. We're going to see the exact phase out moment. And you know what? It's sad for me to see, because I really grew up loving Clash of Champions. But this is still entertaining enough to get a 5. So next week, we're going to go to the competitions show. We're going to go to In Your House, Rage in the Cage, as they say, from February of 96. Matt, what are you expecting when we talk Rage in the Cage next week?
I don't remember, because I don't think I've ever actually seen this show in full. I've seen the main event. I know that. Do I remember anything else from this show? No. So my opinions are to be determined.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that. I obviously have seen this all the way through. I definitely have thoughts on it. Goddamn, WWF was still trying to find their footing. But we'll get there next week. So until next week, when we discuss In Your House 6, Rage in the Cage, we'll see you at the matches. Thanks, Matt.